Support for this News from Lake Wobegon podcast comes from the Sleep Number bed by Select Comfort, the bed that lets you adjust the mattress firmness to your preference, your sleep number. To us growing up in the Midwest, the Irish were a symbol of wildness and romance. And whenever one of us did something that was particularly flamboyant or impractical or dangerous, people would say, well, that's the Irish in him. My Uncle George, when he bought a typewriter one summer to write our family history, my mother said, well, that's the Irish in him, you know. And then he gave it up after 3 weeks because our family didn't have any history to speak of. We were much too cautious to ever have a history. We were the opposite of Irish. My Uncle George was also thought to have some Irish in him because of his hair, which was really a marvel of architecture to look at. He didn't have much of it left, and so he had to husband what he had, and he had to build it up using sprays and a kind of a starch. He had hair that defied the force of gravity. It resembled a birdcage. It was whitish, with some streaks of black in it. And he let his hair grow very long on the one side that he had some hair. And he combed it up and around and curled it around over, and it wound up down in the back. It was really a piece of Art Deco architecture. And it's quite amazing every time he came over to visit. I can remember him coming over to visit on summer nights and sitting there and seeing the sun set through Uncle George's hair. One of those things that you remember. You think you're going to remember other things, you don't, but you do remember this sort of corolla of light around him that was similar to the pictures of our Lord that Catholics had. Except he was not bleeding, of course. His daughter, though, my cousin Helen Marie, was the one who really incorporated whatever we could have called Irishness. She was a piece of work. She was my favorite cousin. The summer I'm thinking of, I was 14 and she was 17 years old. We lived in a town that was half Norwegian Lutheran and half German Catholic, except our family was sanctified brethren. We were a very strict group and a very small group as well, a fundamentalist sect. Very small because we didn't really believe in forgiveness. And here she was, a sanctified brethren child as I was, and her worldly sophistication was just really truly astounding to me. She knew so many swear words that I never knew, and she knew how to smoke a cigarette, and she could smoke it so that she would let the smoke out of her mouth and take it up her nostrils and then breathe it back out. It was so classy, so wonderful to see. I watched her closely. She was such an adventurous soul. Because I was trying to be a writer. I inherited Uncle George's typewriter when he gave it up. I inherited it, and that was the summer that I started to become a writer. And Helen Marie, my cousin, was the only one in the family I could think of interesting enough to write about. I had been a comedian in school and was fairly successful at it. But how good do you have to be to make people laugh when they're that age? Not very hard. But I thought I wanted to go on and become a writer and write stories. I wanted to write stories about the inexplicable, about sudden events that no one could have expected. Something suddenly happening, like a tornado coming. In the Midwest, we have tornadoes that come, and they may start on a very sunny, warm day, and then the sky turns dark in an amazing short time, and this wicked snake of a cloud comes snaking over the horizon, and it proceeds across the landscape, dealing out punishment at random. We'll smash this barn and leave this farm standing. We'll punish the righteous and leave the wicked to prosper, just as it says in Scripture. To me, this was so interesting, and the miraculous things that tornadoes did. There was a tornado that came through town and that impaled blades of grass into a vanity mirror, impaled them into a cast iron skillet, that picked up a whole tea service, cups and saucers and a teapot, and set them down two-thirds of a mile away, unscratched, uncracked, in a field of oats. Who could explain how this could happen? A tornado that impaled seed corn so deep in the linoleum kitchen floor of the Ingebrigtsen family that year after year, though they kept sponge mopping with herbicide, every spring, corn growing out of their kitchen floor. People came from miles around to see it. You could have charged admission. I wanted to write stories about strange things that happen suddenly out of nowhere. I wrote stories about talking animals. A family is sitting in their dining room eating their supper, and their dog walks into the room and speaks up and says, "I wish you people knew what you smell like to me." Family is sitting eating supper, and a woman in a white silk gown with a crown of silver on her head and carrying a blazing torch walks in singing "Onward, Christian Soldiers." I wrote a story in which a man goes to church on Sunday morning and he feels an insect crawling down his leg and does not dare in this congregation thrust his hand down into his pants and dares not stand up until the sermon and the service are over, and by the time he gets out, he has been bitten. He goes to the men's toilet and lowers his trousers, and a spider has bitten him and given him a rare blood disease, and he dies. I liked heavy irony. A story without irony was an opportunity wasted. I love to write stories. My mother loved stories. She would come out and sit out on the porch in the evening with us. My father was there. A summer evening in the Midwest, the end of a warm day. The dog is lying under the porch down in the dirt with his haunches spread to cool off. Your cat is sitting there on the porch swing next to you, a very nervous cat, a cat living in a house with many small children. Every day a new experiment. But in the evening, everything is at rest, and you smell fresh mown grass from your house and your neighbor's lawn, and the lawn sprinkler throws big drops of water up towards the hydrangea bushes just in front of the porch. My father was lying on the daybed listening to baseball on the radio. And when the sun went down and my mother had put the little kids to bed, she came out and sat on the porch and read the newspaper, which she read not for wisdom, not to understand politics, which didn't interest her, not to read about Hollywood stars, which made no sense to her at all, but to read stories of heinous crime. Crime that had come out of nowhere. And when she found a good story, would cluck to herself as she read it through, and then she would read it out loud to us. She said, "Listen to this. Can you believe this? He got in an argument with his mother one morning in the kitchen because she wouldn't give him money for cigarettes. And he picked up the cast iron skillet and he beat her to death with it and threw her body in the woodshed. And then he came back into the kitchen and fixed himself eggs and bacon in the same skillet that he'd killed his mother." What sort of people are these? Well, we knew what sort of people they were. They were not sanctified brethren. They showed the depths that people would wind up at when they put true doctrine aside. She loved stories, and of course she loved it on a Saturday night when my Aunt Flo would come up from the Bon Marché Beauty Salon, and she would bring all of the news of the town that could never be told among men. Men had to be allowed to believe in myth and to accept their illusions. It was only among women that the flat-out truth could be told, and it was told at the beauty salon. It was never reported in the newspaper. And my Aunt Flo brought the news up to us that she heard down there under the hair dryers. News about who was fighting now and who was drinking again, who had tried to stop, and whose children had gone off to the city and were embarrassing them in some entirely new and amazing way. Who had disgraced themselves in some original way. We were Christian people and we believed in forgiveness. But of course, we'd like to know exactly what it was we were forgiving people for. So we could decide whether this was something new or a continuing pattern in their lives. We loved to hear these stories, and I tried to make them into stories. And then one day, my Aunt Flo came up from the Bon Marché Beauty Salon, and she was speaking in a different tone of voice, so as not to be heard by me. And she led my mother into the house, and I heard my cousin Helen Marie's name mentioned, and I knew that this week the news was about us. Helen Marie was Uncle George and Aunt Ruth's only child, their daughter, 17 years old, an independent young woman. We had gone down to a swimming beach one Saturday, a few weeks before this Saturday, and we'd sat there, the two of us, and she told me that if I wanted to learn how to smoke, she'd be happy to teach me. She told me that if I wanted to dance the shimmy, she was the one who could show me how. She said, I wish you wouldn't go around trying to look down the front of my swimming suit and see my breasts. She said, if you want to see them, just ask me. I said, I'm not trying to look at them. Oh, she said, I can tell the way you walk around behind me. Oh, I said, I'm not. I said, I don't need to see them. I said, I'm a writer. Writers can make up these things. She looked around to see that nobody was looking, and she pulled the front of her suit open just for a moment so I could see. I was so grateful. It was such a generous thing to do. I really had no idea. I thought it was something that a writer ought to know. And it was interesting to me what you could get somebody to do for you by feigning disinterest. Now her name was being mentioned in whispers, and I could hear people talking about her. When I went in the house, I could hear my mother on the phone. I heard other relatives talk about her the next day. And 2 days after that, Helen Marie was brought over to our house with a cardboard suitcase by my Uncle George with his amazing hair and was sent up to my sister's bedroom. My sister was away teaching vacation Bible school. I asked my mother, I said, how long is she going to stay with us? Well, my mother said, I don't know. Not for long. My mother said, I don't want you to go and talk with her, though. She needs her rest. I said, is she sick? Mother said, not exactly. I said, what's wrong? Mother said, don't ask so many questions. My family believed in secrecy. They lived by secrecy. Everything that didn't fit within the four frames, the four lines of the rectangle of the true and the good and the beautiful and the permissible, we tucked around behind so that we couldn't see it. Every conversation around a dinner table was like walking through a minefield. You'd come in the vicinity of a certain name, a certain date, an event in the past, and your mother would swing you away from it. I come from a family of people who every time they went up to the toilet would first run water into the basin. These are my people. Members of the family started to gather in our house and go back to the kitchen to have a meeting. My mother said, "This is not for you. This is not for children. I want you to go up to your room." So I went upstairs and I pretended to go into my room. I opened and closed the door, and then I walked down the hall to a grate at the end of the hall near where the linen closet stood. It was a grate that went back to the days when the house was heated by a coal stove in the basement, and grates had to be left for the warm air to rise up to the bedrooms on the second floor. You could put your ear down to that grate where there was now a piece of plywood, and you could hear everything that went on in the kitchen as if you were listening to a radio show. They were all down there, and they were all talking about Helen Marie. And my Uncle Al was saying that Scripture was clear on this point, that she would have to be sent away. She could not be allowed to stay among us. Someone who had committed sin and who was unrepentant had to be put out of the group. The unclean had to be put away. Otherwise, we would be sullied like the Methodists, like the Lutherans, like the Baptists. She had to be sent away. My mother pleaded for her to be allowed to stay with us, but no, she couldn't be allowed to stay unless she made a clear statement of contrition and said in writing that she was truly sorry for what she had done. Otherwise, she would be sent off to a home for unwed mothers in Indiana. So that was what the problem was. Wayne Peterson. Her boyfriend, Wayne Peterson. I thought they had seemed to be spending a lot of time together. I went and knocked on the bedroom door where Helen Marie was. She had been crying. She opened the door. Her eyes were red. She looked so unhappy. She said, "Do you think I'm pretty?" I said, "Yes, I do." She said, "Do you really?" I said, "Yes." But I said, "You have to say you're sorry and say it in writing, or they'll send you away." And they mean it. They really mean it. She said, "I couldn't write a statement like that. It wouldn't be the truth." I said, "I could write it for you." "I could write it for you. Just tell me exactly what happened." She told, but of course with not nearly the detail that one would have hoped for. So I went downstairs and I wrote a statement of contrition for her. I got it out of the Gospels. I'd been to a lot of Gospel meetings. I knew what language to use, that she had wandered away from the truth as she'd been given it, as she'd been privileged to know it. She had taken the broad road and had turned her backs on all those who cared for her. And now she was truly sorry and repentant. She had gone off and eaten the world's husks, and now she was coming back, knowing that she was no longer worthy to be called their daughter, but would they please take her back as one of their servants. It was very good. I did a very good job. But it sort of got lost in all of the excitement that followed, because Wayne Peterson called up my cousin and said, "Well, I guess we better do it." She said, "Well, it's for a lifetime, you know, Wayne." He said, "No, you're telling me." And 6 days later, they were married. 6 days later, he called her on a Sunday, and they were married on a Saturday. In 6 days, the time that it took God to create the world, my Aunt Ruth put together that whole wedding. And the next Saturday, I went with Helen Marie down to the Bon Marché Beauty Salon, the source of news in our town, so she could have her hair done for her wedding that afternoon. She sat down in the chair to have her hair washed, and Luann said, "I'll never forget when I was married, I saw a picture of Grace Kelly in a magazine, and she had her hair done in a French roll, you know, a vertical French roll. I thought I'd like to do mine that way, so I used a toilet paper cardboard roll for the foundation, but I forgot to take all the paper off." And it started to come loose about the time I walked up the aisle. I could feel it bouncing on my back. I passed the front pew, and my mother leaped up out of the pew, and she just tore all of the hairpins out of my hair and tore the paper out. I stood there. I was crying so hard, I didn't know what I was vowing to do or not do. I still don't remember. Helen Marie started to cry. Everybody was quiet. She sat in the chair, having her hair washed, tears running down her cheeks. Everyone listened to her, listening to the tears of the bride on her wedding day, knowing that feeling. How when you have your life story all lined up, and you know what's going to happen next, and you've chosen this man who seems to fit the part, and you've made an agreement with him, now the closer you come to the wedding, the less you know this person. The closer you come, the more he seems like a stranger, like he seems like a hitchhiker that you picked up on the highway. And now on the morning of your wedding, you have no idea. You thought you knew and you don't. Is this person a jerk? Who is he? You have no idea. She wept. She went and sat under the dryer. She was crying. Mrs. Krebsbach, Myrtle Krebsbach, an old woman in our town who's pushing 70. Some people say she's pulling 70. Still has her hair dyed jet black every Saturday. She looks like Batgirl. She put her hand on my cousin's shoulder and she said, "Honey," she said, "the wedding is the hard part. Take my word for it, I know. The wedding is the hard part, and what comes afterward is not nearly as bad as you might think." Helen Marie sat and she had her chignon done. She was weeping, and all of them were listening to her. And if she had said, "I can't do this, get me out of here," they would have helped her. But she didn't. And so, when her hairdo was finished, they all stood around her. All stood close by her and admired her and told her how beautiful she looked. All of these old sorceresses, these old oracles, the old priestesses of our town, even knowing what they knew about romance and love, still they wished her well. I wrote a poem for her a few years ago on her 40th anniversary. A summer night and you and paradise. Around your head the universe has hung its lights. So lovely and so full of grace. I raise my hand and touch your face. I believe in impulse, in all that is green. Believe in the foolish vision that comes out true. Believe that all that is essential is unseen. And for this lifetime, I believe in you. All of the lovers and the love they made, nothing that was between them was a mistake. All that we did for love's sake was not wasted and will never fade. All who have loved will be forever young and walk in grandeur on a summer night along the avenue. They live in every song that is sung, in every painting of pure light, in every pas de deux. Love that shines from every star, love reflected in the silver moon. It is not here, but it's not far. Not yet, but it will be here soon. That's the news from Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, all the men are good-looking, and all the children are above average.